What I liked about his work was that he said design, you know, that the fact that it looks good is not just a luxury, it's a necessity.
Hi everyone, welcome to a new episode of Data Stories. We're back. It's incredible. After months of silence, we finally made it. Anyways, glad to be back. My name is Moritz Stefaner. I'm an independent designer of data visualizations, and I work as a self-employed truth and beauty operator out of my office here in the countryside in the beautiful north of Germany.
And I am Enrico Bertini. I am a professor at New York University, where I teach and do research in data visualization. And I'm not in New York right now, but it's fine. Normally I'm there in normal
times.
Where
did you go? Where did you escape to?
It's a secret.
In a secret location. But I
in
hear
the
there's
mountains.
A lot of snow in it.
I'm hiding
place.
In the mountains.
Very good. As one should in these times. Anyways, on this podcast, together we talk about data visualization, data analysis, and generally the role data plays in our lives. And usually we do that together with a guest we invite on the show.
That's right. But before we start, a usual quick note. Our podcast is listener supported, so there's no ads, which is quite nice. And if you enjoy the show, please consider supporting us with recurring payments on patreon.com/datastories. Or if you prefer, you can also send us one-time donations on PayPal following this URL, paypal.me/datastories.
Yeah. So the topic today is one we had on our list for a long time. We are going to discuss Edward Tufte's work and his new book. So he has a new book out. It's called Seeing with Fresh Eyes. And yeah, we'll use the opportunity to talk about this whole body of work and his influence on the data viz scene. And I'm sure many of you will have heard of him. And if not, you will hear about what this man has contributed to our little data viz scene. And we have a special guest we want to bring on later. But before, we wanted to mention a few quick projects we've been working on in the meantime. So The first thing, what kept me busy and honestly also sort of kept us a bit from recording, I'll have to admit, was I was involved, I still am, in the German COVID-19 vaccination dashboard. So it's the Impf dashboard, vaccination dashboard. And yeah, we built an interactive mobile-first site showing all the vaccination statistics in Germany. Launched it like 6 weeks ago and now keep updating it and keep refining it. And it's great to be involved in something as important as this, but also quite demanding, of course, as you can imagine. Anyways, you can check it out. We'll put the link in the show notes, and it should hopefully translate well also to other languages. At least that was our goal.
Yeah, that's a big project, Moritz. Congratulations. With this, you're reaching, I don't know how many people, but it must be exciting and frightening at the same time.
Yeah, and it's really like relevant information, and we want to get everything right. And one of our goals was really to make it so accessible that everybody can consume it well.
Yeah.
And so we didn't like try to do super fancy Sankey diagrams or cool interactive charts, but really nail the basics really well and have really good text and generate text automatically and have really accessible and responsive charts. And I'm sort of also a bit proud how it turned out.
Of course. should be.
And it's worked together with Studio Nant and Cosmonauts at Kings, I should mention.
So I'm just the usual suspects.
Yeah. that's true. That's true. By now, yes.
By now.
Yeah. What have you been up to, Enrico?
Lots of crazy things in my life,
but
on the more professional side of things, I just want to quickly mention a couple of things. There's a tool that we are publishing online that is called Slice Lens, and it's part of our larger effort to create data visualization tools to help people understand machine learning models. Mm-hmm. And so how do you support, say, data scientists or even domain experts in understanding how a model behaves before you actually put it in production, which, as you can imagine, is quite important. Mm-hmm. And Slice Lens is one of the first things that we are publishing out there. It's a little tool where you can select the attributes or variables of your data set and see how the model behaves in specific subsets. And the idea is that the system guides you in selecting these subsets. So mm-hmm. you're not just aimlessly browsing. The system tells you, oh, since you're selecting this, why don't you look at that? Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a little bit of a recommendation engine behind it. So I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. I like that a lot. It's really simple, but really clever. And I think the general paradigm of, oh, here's a split of the data you might want to look at, is really powerful. And that's
what I love of the project, even though sometime in the research community, people say, this is too simple, which is like, it should be a positive thing, right? Yeah, it's too simple. What is too simple? Anyway, so the second thing I want to briefly mention is that my excellent PhD student, Daniel Kerrigan, has been helping me over the last 2 years with my InfoVis course, and has mm-hmm. been developing over time observable notebooks for teaching. And I started publishing some of these notebooks online, and I'm so happy with it. And mm-hmm. As a general remark, observable for teaching has been a godsend for us. I absolutely love mm-hmm. it. I could talk for hours about it. But if you want to take a look, we will put the links in the show notes. And I'm happy to share, because they can be used by other teachers or people who want to learn through these notebooks. So the collection is growing. So it's a good resource. I like it a lot.
Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, that's another thing that happened in the meantime. D3 turned 10 years old, right? And that's been like the most influential data visualization library. Yeah. And as some of you know, like Mike Bostock, the original like author of D3, moved on to working on Observable a few years ago. And it's really turning out to be a really promising platform for creating cool interactive data viz and sharing data viz and sharing the makings of DataVis, right?
Yeah,
and
so exactly.
That might be worth another whole episode.
Oh, yeah.
Observable in specific, or interactive notebooks, interactive documents, such a cool field.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, that's for another day. Yeah. Today, we want to discuss more classical stuff than futuristic interactive notebooks. We want to talk about Edward Tufte's work and his perspective on DataVis. And we have a special guest that some of you might be familiar with from previous episodes, or because she was part of the Data Stories team even. And so hi, and special welcome to Sandra Rentgen. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Moritz. Hi, Enrico. It's really great to be back. Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Yeah. Yes. And it's fun.
Yeah. And I think you're a perfect match for this episode. You're an acclaimed author yourself. You know a lot about historical DataVis as well. Mm-hmm. And you have followed the scene for a long time. So we are really interested in hearing your thoughts about Edward Tufte's work.
Yeah, I think we can throw a good mix of opinions together, also because we come from different backgrounds, like mm-hmm. the three of us. So I think it's going to be a good mixture.
Yeah, absolutely. What is your background, by the way, for all the people who don't follow you?
My background, that's a good question. I should note right at the beginning, I'm more of a humanities person, actually. Mm-hmm. I've studied art history and cultural theory. So that's more of, that's sort of the background I'm coming from. And as some of you may know, I've started looking at the field of InfoVis, DataVis some 12 years ago, mm-hmm. Looking more at contemporary work in the field and trying to observe how it evolves, how the whole DataVis scene evolves. And then a few years ago, I also turned into looking at the history, and I've published two books about that as well. Mm-hmm. And that was really interesting. And that's also, very related to Edward Tufte's work, because he's also done a lot about making us observe the history of the field. So mm-hmm.
And your last book looked at Charles Minard's work called The Minard System.
Exactly.
You went into great depth discussing all of this great historical works from Charles Minard from the 19th century.
Exactly. And yeah, it was really Tufte and also Michael Friendly who sort of paved the ground mm-hmm. for this kind of research. So I guess we can look into a little bit into how they started threads of research with their books. And so Edward Tufte has certainly provided a lot of impulses for that.
Yeah. I mean, maybe to provide a bit of background. So he used to be a professor for political science and statistics and computer science at Yale. And I think he wrote his first books in the 80s, I would say, right? Sandra, do you know when the series started, like he's famous for?
Yeah, the first book came out in 1982. That was the publishing date, but I know he's been working on it a few years earlier. Yeah. So the research and the concept for the book goes back to the 70s.
Yeah, and that first book is The Visual Display of Quantitative Information. I think without spoiling anything, I think it's one of the cornerstone books in data visualization.
Yep.
Or maybe...
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's like one of these Lonely Island books, like if you can only bring three books. I think for many of us, it would be one of the ones. Mm-hmm. The first few pages are just a home run. You know, he starts with Ainscombe's quartet. Like, why do we even visualize... And he has so good examples, like why visuals are so much more powerful than any other form of representing information. Mm-hmm. Then Jon Snow, the cholera map, Charles Minard's the famous March to Moscow mm-hmm. diagram. It's all there just on the first few pages, like, you know. And for a lot of people, that was the first exposure, as you said, to, oh, there has been data visualization before Excel, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
And it's actually super interesting, you know, what people did in the 19th century. And I think, roughly speaking, I would say half of the people I know in data visualization say this book sort of opened their eyes or that made them move into data visualization from some other field, right? Or at least one of the Tufte books. Is that fair to say? Is that your perception as well? Or is that just my little bubble of Tufte fans?
Enrico, what would you say?
Well, that was definitely the case for me. I can't say if it was the first book I read on visualization, but one of the first, and it had a huge impact on the way I saw visualization and its relevance in the world, and also just being fascinated, completely fascinated mm-hmm. by it. I clearly remember this idea, I want to do this. It's like, when I discovered this, I
so
had no
cool.
doubts.
Yeah.
I wanted to work on this, right? I never had a doubt. Yeah. So in this sense, Tufte was a huge influence. And especially mm-hmm. the first book, I have to say. Mm-hmm. I still refer back to those concepts and... I think it's also worth mentioning and fair to say that it's the most structured book, right? Where Tufte really tries to come up with principles, guidelines, things that stuck right in your mind and you keep reminding yourself all the time or finding mm-hmm. examples that match mm-hmm. those guidelines, right?
Yeah. Also, in a way that he's very good in putting observation into succinct words, basically, into succinct rules that you can follow. And that sort of, as you said, that sort of stick in your mind. And the other thing that I think is really interesting about this book is that it's a very rare, up to this date, it's a very rare combination of design. I mean, a lot, like a huge part of the book is about design excellence. And it's not just that he writes about it. He, like the book embodies this concept, right? And this is very, up to this date, it's very rare to have this like really close combination of scientific rigor that mm-hmm. he's also campaigning for throughout the book. That's like also a huge part of the book, campaigning for statistical rigor and scientific rigor, but also for design excellence. And the book is the way it's laid out and the way it's arranged is also very, very convincing in that sense. And I don't know very many other books who've achieved that. Right, this combination of intellectual rigor and design. So that's I guess true. That's
the German
also,
word Gesamtkunstwerk comes to mind.
Yeah, Gesamtwerk. And that's probably also part of why it was so influential. And what I was going to add was that I know, because Moritz, you said that many people got into the field through this book. What I want to add is that, interestingly, I think he made a huge step into the design community who saw a first, you know, who saw a book that was very well laid out, very well, that had, you know, a lot of design principles in it, but was tackling a field that the design community wasn't really interested in before, you know, before this book came out, before the 80s. So there was, I think that the people who looked at design and in visualization, that was really just a very few people. And so I guess this is one very big achievement of this first book, having made popular the whole database field in the design community.
Yeah. And I think we'll discuss his key concepts also later, but we can also first give a bit of an overview of his total like series of books, right? And then sort of dive into the details there. Sorry, Enrico, I cut you off.
Go ahead. No, that's fine. I just wanted to say that still today, I think people who are not working directly in visualization, but when they talk about information design or give suggestions about information design, they would refer anyone to Tufte, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First book, Visual Display of Quantitative Information. True classic. Second one, Envisioning Information.
Yeah.
This one's a bit more qualitative and a bit more varied, a bit more illustration heavy also. Like it's more colorful and more pictorial is my recollection, right? So it's a really nice compliment because the first one was really about data and little dots and lines and, you know, numbers. And the second one was more about concepts and categories and topics, themes. Thematic illustration.
Yeah.
Really nice one too. I love this one as well. The third one.
I think what he does there, sorry, just briefly, I think what he does there still somewhat systematically talks about color in a somewhat systematic way. And he has this concept of layering and separation that I think it's hard to grasp.
Visual hierarchy.
Yeah. Visual hierarchy. So there are some, and if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that the idea of small multiples appears there first, not in the first book. Maybe I'm wrong.
Is it in the first book, but it's called Phillips plot. Oh, no, the Phillips plot was the connected scatter plot that appeared there out of nowhere. And I was like, wow, it's a connected scatter plot from the 70s. And now everybody thinks it's a new invention. But Tufte had it like on page, I don't know, 17 in his first book. So that's like fun. But yeah, the small multiples, maybe they came in the second book. Could be.
I think he has a whole chapter.
I know, it's on page 48. He has a small multiples page.
Oh,
small multiples of connected scatter plots. Oh my God. Be still my heart.
In 80 what?
Yeah, and it's from the 70s. So, you know, that's the thing. Yeah. So we keep rediscovering all this stuff that Tufte has already like discovered in the 80s. Yeah. That's the way things go. Anyways, good book too. Then we have two follow-up books, Visual Explanations and Beautiful Evidence. I would say it's fair to say these get a bit more anecdotal. Like each chapter presents one idea, but it's not an overarching argument anymore. But it's more like, hey, here's another thing I'm interested in now.
Yeah. There's less of an overarching theme, right?
Yeah, it's more like, and it's like he goes into sculptures or he goes into, I don't know, individual techniques he's interested in. But it becomes more a collection of interests.
What is something that is new in those later books is sort of an interest in pictorial strategies, sort of like how can you use images to sort of persuade or bring evidence or something. So, but as you said, it has a bit of an anecdotal character in that he just sort of finds, and I think generally that's sort of one of his strengths really through all of his books, that he's very good in curating stuff, in finding information, finding examples, and showing their relevance for the whole practice of visualization. And sometimes a bit more synthesis would be revealing to see how you could use this particular strategy or how you could this particular method and device. But overall, it's very good to have all this knowledge or all these examples collected. And I think, we are now with the third one, right? Visual explanations, images and quantities.
But beautiful evidence. I see these two as very similar in a way that they present the same style of arguments.
Exactly. So for the listener, maybe the third one was called Visual Explanations, Images, Quantities, Evidence, and Narrative. It came out in 2006. And the title of the last one is Beautiful Evidence.
Good title.
Good title, yeah. How come you like it?
He has a thing for good names. So maybe one of his big contributions is also just finding catchy names for an already existing stuff, like small multiples, spark lines. So he has this thing with finding characteristic names.
Which is, it sounds maybe like as if you just put some tarnish on something that was already there. But I think there's also a cognitive thing in that because, you know, giving these things a good title is, you know, as you said before, it makes people remember those concepts. And that's there's an achievement in that because, you know, in the sense of these books are books that many people read who want to go into the field and have done so over the past 2-3 decades, basically. And so if these titles make people remember those concepts, then there's something good about that, really. Because, you know, he's really good at pointing his finger at it and say, hey, look, there's some really good stuff in that. And it can do something, like, on a cognitive level. So
That is true. And, like, being precise about what you mean with a certain new concept you coin, I think that can be super helpful. At the same time, sometimes people think just because you coined a term, you invented the whole concept or the whole genre. And I think that's not true in some cases. Like small multiples existed before or sparklines existed before, but just weren't called that way. And now because David Tufte coined the term and sort of illustrated the concept really well, people think he invented the whole thing, which is not true. But I see your point as well. That there's a whole merit in being able to providing a succinct definition and a good name to something that's complex.
Yeah, and making people remember the concept. And, you know,
it's almost like a data viz strategy in itself.
No, I think some people have this amazing skill of coining some terms that stick. And it's useful. I think it's useful. It can also be detrimental to some extent, of course, right? But I agree with Sandra. The mere fact that you attach a label to a concept, now people remember that, right? I'm thinking other examples from other people, right? I don't know. System one, system two thinking, right? Once you understand, it's super simple, but right?
It's like, also really a bad name, but it works.
It's horrible, right? But here we go, right? And we all know what we're talking about.
That's true,
Or, I don't know, another... Ben Schneiderman is really good at doing that, for instance. He always comes up with really good acronyms, right? Or overview first, then details on demand. Once you hear it, it's like, here we go. You see it everywhere. Right?
And it's so true. And you know what? The funny thing is that overview first, details on demand, I have often used it in presentations about historical stuff, like way before interaction design, because basically this is a strategy that people have used in old maps, like right. You can if you have a huge wall map, you can go back, you can step back and see it from a distance and get the whole picture, and then you can go into it and zoom in. I mean, you can do that. You could do that before digital media, and so. But it's really good to put this concept into this phrase because it makes people remember it and also puts a light on this or sheds a light on this specific strategy, which is cool.
Yeah, absolutely true. And finally, then we have the Seeing with Fresh Eyes, Meaning Space Data Truth book, which I personally must say, I find it maybe the weakest of the five. So that's why I wanted to sort of lay out the full sequence first, because the other ones are so strong that the expectations are really high. And this one really seems like a collection of not totally finished like chapters, is my feeling. Again, there's really good thoughts in there. There's a really cool chapter on typography, which is something that's often undervalued in data visualization.
So much.
Or not looked at systematically, and it's so important. And it is a form of data visualization, how you arrange a sentence on a page, or where do you do the line breaks, and what do you make bold or not. You know, it's super powerful. There's stuff on annotations. It opens really wild, like loose stream of consciousness type thoughts. And so he clearly tries something new in a way. Mm-hmm. Also with the layout, like the layout is sort of weird actually, but experimental, let's say, to frame it positively. But for me, it didn't quite click as the other books, I must say. How about you guys?
Well, I think it was in terms of layout. I think it looks deliberate to me that it's more how do you say that? It's more a like a web of associations.
Yeah,
that
collage.
A collage kind of style, which is sometimes hard to like to cut through the mist. It doesn't have the very clear structure and threads basically that you have in, for instance, in the first book. You know, it sort of just guides you through. Yeah. But also maybe you could see, like at first I had the same feeling like you, Moritz, that I was basically overwhelmed with the layout. I just, you know, couldn't really find my way through it. But it also may have been, I think it may have an association to, or it is a web of associations that you are presented with. And what I'm missing a little bit is sort of the guideline that takes you through and the synthesis. And
maybe his first two books are like really modernist, and now he's entered the postmodern age. Is that what's happening?
Exactly. That's sort of how it feels to me. And in that sense, there's a huge wealth in it, a huge wealth of examples and ideas. As you said, it's I didn't really understand who it was for. In the sense of is it like a textbook? Mm. Is it for people who are looking to go into data viz? Is it for, you know, is it more for an advanced audience? I wouldn't really be able to tell, because there's also for instance, it starts with some remarks on what I would call scientific rigor and you know, rigorous thinking, trying to question assumptions, things like that. Remodel conventional models is one of his phrases and claims, and that for me goes into something that what I would call, you know, general scientific hygiene that students should be taught students and everybody who's in academia should follow.
And there's a huge chapter on how academia is broken, or why so many, the replication crisis and all of that. That seems to be the biggest part of the book, actually. Like taking science apart.
Yeah, and then we have, as you said, we have the content responsive typography and the whole notion of annotation and how you can do that. Which has a lot of interesting concepts. Then there's a lot of data analysis, remarks about data analysis when truth matters, and some remarks about lists, some remarks about instructions at point of need. Again, something that I thought was an interesting concept to have annotations and instructions at what he called the point of need, so that they're like placed precisely.
That's another element that is often overlooked in visualization, or very often, and super important.
Yeah, and again, I thought it's a very good phrasing that sort of directs attention to the problem, which is an achievement. And then the last chapter is on remodeling nonfiction presentations, so how to get smarter and shorter meetings.
So it's a sort of a mixed bag, let's say. My recommendation would be, if you have the other four ones, you need to buy it just to complete the series. if you don't own any of the Tufte books, start at the beginning. That would be my, like, you know, the quick summary review, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, maybe just to make sure because not everybody might be familiar with his main concepts from the earliest books, maybe we should go through his key contributions, right? Just to make sure people are familiar with them. So what would you say are the main concepts he presents in the first books?
I think I've said it before. What I think is a huge achievement, and that's really what made him famous, is the combination of claiming, and that really happened in the first book. And as you said, Moritz, it happened on the very first pages. So it's like you go into the book and you're drawn into that. And that is the combination of claiming scientific and or statistical rigor, claiming rigor in treating, in how the data are treated in visualization. So just to what I like to call hygiene sometimes, just a good way of working. And that combined with with claiming a very high design standard. And what I liked about his work was that he said, you know, we need a good design, not just as, you know, it's not about decoration. It's not about luxury. Mm. Design, you know, the fact that it looks good is not just a luxury. It's a necessity because it helps perception. It helps the way, you know, data is mediated. And so this contribution of him showing the importance of design and embodying this by, you know, self-publishing his book, just as a side note, because we haven't really said it, he tried to find a publisher. As I said, he had been researching the topics of the book. He was also connected with a few other people, such as Howard Wehner and Micah Friendly and others, who were sort of trying to rediscover ideas, older ideas about data visualization. He had been researching for the book, sometime in the 70s already. Didn't find a publisher who was willing to make sure the design standards that he wanted, and like the placing of images with the text and the quality of images, like, you know, the quality in which images are printed, all that stuff. And I know that it's up to this day, academic publishing and images is a difficult question. And so he didn't find a publisher who would do that, who was willing to do that, who was willing to invest that money also. And so he took out a second mortgage on his home in order to publish.
The move, no? It's like
quite a move. And I mean, imagine.
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, he did. He's I don't know where I have it from. He said it in some of his books. Like it's
I recall that detail too, and I was impressed with it as well.
Oh,
I think I have the second edition of the first book, The Visual Display of Quantitative, and he says that in the introduction to the second edition. So it's quite you must be very convinced and very, you know, it must be a very important topic to you. And he's done that. And I think he's really shown, I think his wife is a designer, so he does have this knowledge, you know, close by. And I don't know if they work together on the book, but you see this in the first book, this level of design excellence. And he's also talking about it. And this combination, statistical rigor, design rigor together, that's like
also practice, think, what you preach, in the sense that you have a theory, but you prove the theory by doing it, sort of.
And I think that really gave a huge push to the whole field, also in making it appeal to a lot more people, rather than just, you know, a few statisticians, basically. And and just making it also for a huge public, making it more attractive. So the other thing that was personally for me super interesting and super exciting also was that he went about and tried finding historical stuff. So he really wanted to go back and see, hey, where does this all come from? I know that practically back in the 80s, it was actually quite a bit of work to find historical database because there were no specialized libraries, there were no online digitized archives of anything. He and a few other people actually went through catalogs of map dealers and rare book dealers to find historical atlases of database, to find historical like broadsheet prints, etc. And so this, much of this has gone into his first book. Some of you will know that he has also collected, like he's built a collection of historical stuff, some of which has made its way into the book. And he, I don't recall the exact year, but I think around 2010, he sold this collection with the auction house Christie's. But just like the fact that he's put so much effort and probably money into building this collection and just trying to get a sense of, you know, what is the history that we have behind us, was really revealing to me personally, and I think to many, many other people in the field. And he's also made it popular. Like the whole idea of me looking into Minar, for instance, goes back to his first book.
Yeah. So there's a whole young generation now of folks looking into the historical side of database and like finding obscure books and
You know, and that's again, that's something that is. It always was a collective effort. Like he was not the only one. As I said, some other people were always also involved. And also now, also today, like I've published some stuff, but there's also other people like Jason Forrest and RJ Andrews and many people who are really digging to find stuff. And like the more we dig, this it's like it's huge. It's becoming ever bigger. So we see all of this tradition that we have behind us and all of what we can build upon. But it's Tufte who really made this popular. Who really said, "Hey, let's look at that. That's so interesting, and we need to know about that."
Yeah, I think it would be, if I'm not mistaken, he never really describes in his books what is the process that he followed to do that, right? Mm-hmm. Are there any accounts about how he got started or what process he followed? It must be a huge amount of work. Right? It's like...
You mean the historical research or
the historical research, general?
Well, as I said, I think back in the 80s, it was really a lot of traveling, talking to dealers, like rare book dealers, antiquarians, map dealers, and just like being in touch with like a number, like a network of people. There's also a community in France of people who was looking into that. So there was, you know, of course, the French rare book dealers who also had the like the statistical atlases of the late 19th century were collecting them and stuff. So there was a lot of exchange between, you know, France and the US and between Michael Friendly and Edward Tufte. And so several people were working on that. And I think they also worked together. Like, you know, they saw one piece there with this rare book dealer and one of them would buy that. And then somebody else would buy another piece from another dealer. And so you see, they sort of had, as I said, it was really a collective effort and they actually had to buy that stuff because you couldn't, you know, as I said, there weren't any kind of digitized archives or something, otherwise you would just have to travel to Paris to look at something in a real archive. Mm. And as I said, he was not the only one to do that, but he certainly, through his books, he's really managed to popularize the whole topic and make us aware that it's not something new and that there's people who have done research on this, like since way back when.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these, I think, are the main contributions that made him resonate for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think I'd like to move the discussion a bit also to what Tufte thinks makes a good data graphic, because I think he has a very clear theory there. And I personally have a bit of a torn relationship. Like in some aspects of the theory, I totally find myself. And in other aspects, I find like, maybe that went a bit too far, or sort of in the way it was then executed in the world, like took things too much to an extreme. And I'm curious about your thoughts there as well. And I think the main idea he presents in his first books is really every single pixel in a graphic should be connected to data and present data. So it's this sort of really extreme purism, minimalism, which is great and which can lead to really super elegant and clever and really rich graphics. So I think if it's done well, it can also lead to something centrally very rich. So it doesn't have to be deprived of experience just because you're minimal. Mm-hmm. But he also introduces these ideas of a lie factor, like how much is a graphic misleading, or he talks about chunk charts. So he has certain types of graphics, data graphics, that he says are really actually bad or like trash in a way. And often that's connected to non-data illustration elements or mm-hmm. like cutesy ideas or like not totally super highly functional stuff or not obviously functional stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that led to a certain austerity in data visualization for a few years, or that sort of over like exaggerated, but Tufty said we cannot add icons, you know, that would be confusing to the people. That would sort of ruin our data ink ratio, you know? So I think Tufty himself enjoys interesting visuals, like even if they're not data-based. So clearly, you know, he has all these mm-hmm. examples. But just the theory he presents in the books, and that theory is not proven empirically, so that's another point I want to make later. But in the theory he presents in the books, I think it comes across very much as very restrictive and very no fun allowed. And yeah. I would argue history has proven him wrong, because we have seen really, really successful data visualization mm-hmm. that where not every single data point is directly connected to data, and that has illustrative elements, and that's like very handmade. Maybe think of Giorgia Luppi's work or Nigel Holmes, who he really bashes in his books and who is mm-hmm. definitely a really influential data illustrator,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. who yeah. is sort of, he does great work. And if you look at what's today, let's say the standard for data visualization in magazines, on websites, it's not very Tuftian, right? And I think we have moved on from that pure idea of, or that maybe idealized idea of the pure data chart that is ideal in any way. What's your take on that?
Yeah,
Enrico, do you want to go first?
Yeah. I don't know where to start because I have so many things
so
to say.
So many points.
I'm overwhelmed by my thoughts.
Take it one by
but,
one.
A couple of things. One is, part of me is, I don't disagree with you, Moritz. One thing is, I'm wondering if partly his old theory is a reaction, is a strong reaction to what he was seeing, or how he was seeing data graphics being used in the world, right? I suspect that
right.
he came
yeah.
from this whole idea that statistical graphs are mostly being presented to the large public through newspapers, and they're mm-hmm. often like complete garbage, for lack of a better word, right? To say it bluntly, and mm-hmm. maybe probably you overcompensated for right as a reaction to what
yeah.
he was seeing
okay.
around.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's an hypothesis, mm-hmm. honestly. Mm-hmm. I never spoke with Tufty, so
yeah.
how do I know?
But it
maybe,
seems plausible.
Maybe,
like yeah,
right,
yeah.
I think it seems plausible. What else did I want to say? Yeah, he has all this concept like data ink ratio, lie factor, junk charts. I think everyone has been influenced by that. And I certainly have been influenced by that a lot. I think part of me is also, I think visualization has changed quite a lot over the years. And these, I think maybe another way to look at this tension, so to speak, is that I think Tufty was mostly addressing the idea of having efficient graphics, right? This idea of efficiency, mm-hmm. right? Whereas we now use visualization for different kind of purposes, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So visualization can also be used as having an experience, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are lots of really good designers. I think you mentioned Giorgia. I think it's an excellent example there. In her work, you are not only extracting information from a piece of graphics, but you are having an experience,
right?
Right? And if you want to maximize for experience, now maybe data ink ratio is not your most important parameter.
Yeah. Or right? memorability, right? And
or
we have studies showing
right?
that
yeah,
more embellished graphics can
yeah,
be more
exactly.
effective in terms of memorability. Right?
Exactly, yeah. exactly.
Mm.
Yeah, that's my take on it. I just want to say I'm going to throw a challenge at you, Moritz.
Ooh, I love challenges.
Your work looks to me mostly like striving for, I think I know you well enough to say that.
Yeah, yeah. You know me well enough
I'm
to insult
here.
Me really well.
I'm cheating yeah. here. But every element in your graphic has to matter, right?
I know. So, yeah, that's
right. So I think you're kind of faking it.
I know.
It sounds to me yeah. they're kind of faking it yeah. to some extent yeah. because mm-hmm. Your work is very tough tasks in some in
yeah.
some sense.
Yeah, that's why the love hate relationship.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But maybe. Maybe. Mm?
No, yeah, I don't have anything to add. I just wanted to,
yeah.
to make fun.
Maybe
of
I can give it some more. I feel like we don't see this. Let me say it differently. I think we should see this more in a historical development. The first book came out in 1982,
yeah.
and I said
yeah.
the research goes back to the 70s. Yeah. I think you're right in saying much of it was a reaction to what he saw, but generally what we can say is the field was always, at least at that point, the field, second part of the 20th century, the field was already at least differentiated into something that was the media, newspapers, magazines.
Yeah.
They had been using graphics for a long time.
Yeah.
We also have this other field of scientific, diagrams in scientific contexts.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really, I mean, he has examples from both ends, but he never really differentiates between those two fields.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you said earlier. We use visualization for different ends. And that has been the case back then already. And I think some of his criticism is more related to the media graphics, from which he asked more statistical rigor and said, hey, people, you cannot do that this way.
Right.
It's just statistical crap what you're doing just to make it look interesting. You know, that was targeted at media graphics, at media, like newsroom departments. But then the other stuff, much of the design excellence, the graphical excellence, I think much of that goes for the more scientific community that were using diagrams, for whom I believe I haven't really seen large collections of that, but I would assume that back in the 70s, 60s, 80s, much of the scientific graphics were just looking like hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I would assume, but that's a speculation, that you know it would have been helpful to sort of differentiate this more and say, like, hey, these people need more of that, these people need more of that. But then, we had graphics for different uses back then already. And I guess also we need to look at the fact that, again, the book came out in 82, and he just managed to build himself such a reputation, which is great.
Right,
but
right.
Through this and through those sentences being repeated all over again and again and again, they sort of had this the Ten Commandments of database
exactly,
status.
Exactly.
And that sort of them being repeated all over again,
yeah.
which has, it had something good, I'm pretty sure. And as you said, Moritz, to Enrico, to Moritz, it had an influence on our generation.
Absolutely.
Like
yeah,
a
yeah.
deep influence. Mm. But at some point it just became like, carved into stone.
Yeah.
And at that point, I think we had some criticism coming up where
yeah.
people would say, well, you know, it is true and, you know, there is some truth to it, but, you know, you need to see this more in context
yeah.
or there's more to it.
And always take it with a grain of salt and understand that it originated in a certain context, that his mindset is very print-centered also. And
mm-hmm.
by now we have digital
yeah.
design and we have all kinds yeah. of media. We have motion graphics, right? And I think he's to some degree acknowledges that, but doesn't really quite grasp what a fundamental change that can make to a design that is presented on a totally different medium. I recall in his books, he criticizes these Thunderstorm graphics, but that were on really crappy TV sets, and he makes these beautiful print redesigns, right? Which, of course, it looks awesome in print, you know? These iPhone weather app redesigns that really would work on an iPhone. And I think understanding, the context he's coming from and what he was arguing against at the time maybe makes one realize, oh, okay, it's a super interesting, total package of thoughts and theory, but it also has sort of a limited applicability, maybe, you know? And it's not the single truth about data visualization that is. Or the Ten Commandments, I love that, analogy.
But you know what? When I looked through the last book, interestingly, I mean, we said earlier that we were having a bit of trouble with the fact that it's basically a collection of ideas or thoughts where we felt, where's the overarching argument? What is it aimed for? But I had a moment, I mean, there's very interesting examples of what he calls graphical sentences, which is basically relating to, sentences or lines of text which are taken out of a text grid and just basically applied freewheeling in space wherever they help the content that is being mediated. So that's one of the concepts. He also talks about, content responsive typography and how line breaks that, refer to specific content elements could help meaning, could help creating, or could help understanding also. And I was thinking, at reading it, I was like, I was missing the reference to the specific media technologies in which this could be used. I mean, of course, you can make. He quotes one of the famous calligrams by Apollinaire, the French poet. Mm. And of course, it's a beautiful thing. And of course, you can do that by hand, manually, and arrange the typography in a sense that helps the meaning. Of course,
when the first typewriters came out, there was a lot of these concrete poetry experiments, right?
And it's beautiful, and I understand the thing, and I also understand how it could relate to helping mediating meaning in DataVis, but this is not practical. How are you ever going to use that in one of the current contemporary DataVis tools, softwares, whatever? But maybe maybe this is something that's more pointing towards the future, let's say like this. If you have something like responsive typography, if you have more flexible things coming up, maybe this is a pool of ideas that people can come back to with later stages of technology development.
Yeah.
Maybe. Because this is ideas that many of them are based in the print universe.
Yeah.
But I don't know what we have seen a very fast technological development in Viz tools over the past 10 years. I don't know what's coming up. So maybe there's a pool, and that's what I like about the last book. Maybe it can be seen as a sort of a bit of a wild pool of ideas that could inform future solutions.
I mean, the last book is more on the art side again, He's always jumping between art and science anyways. And I think that the last book swung the pendulum again to the art side. the relation to science is interesting too, I think, because he has, as you said, he presents this rigor and he has this ask for clarity and really being really strict about what everything means. And I do think he lays out his thoughts really well in that way, but he never proves anything with empirical findings, right? I think that that's another interesting observation. I think that he's all about science, except the science of data visualization, right? Enrico, does that match your perspective, or what's your thought on that?
I think it's interesting because some of the basic perceptual studies done in visualization started, again, in the 80s, right? The work of Cleveland and McGill. He must have been or is familiar with this body of work, right? Especially because it's been hugely influential. I don't know why. I think he never really talks about empirical evidence. He might actually sometimes contradict or sometimes support his intuitions. I don't know. It's interesting. I think it would be interesting to ask him, right?
But there's a weird tension in saying like, oh, we need to be super rigorous about our process and justify everything, really well, what we do in our graphics, but then just come up with opinions. You know, it's that sort of a weird tension, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yeah. I think it's also true that a lot of additional evidence has been collected later on in the years. Mm-hmm. But again, he never mentions that in the newer books. So I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's also fine. I mean, everybody has a different role to play in such a community or in such a like constellation, right? Maybe his role is just opening up all these doors and then other people need to see what's exactly inside and to sort of organize, you know, his trail of connections. I don't know. That's fine.
Yeah, I think when I think about his way of communicating his thoughts, I think he really approaches this with the way designers would do it, right? Moritz, you can correct me. But I think designers have more of they want to communicate things by example, not by saying, this is what science says, right?
So
I'll give you a concept and then I'll give you a bunch of examples that show the application of that concept.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a different way of learning, teaching and learning things, right? And by the way,
he is a design teacher, I would agree. And he does a lot of teaching in workshops as well. And he has taught like hundreds of thousands of students.
Exactly.
And I would agree that the style of teaching he probably has, like coming from the book, then it is it's not a scientific way of teaching, but more a practical perspective and sharpening one's intuitions, right? But I think it's weird because the content itself is so much about rigor and absolute truths, which seems weird.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's definitely a tension there. But I have to say,
right? What can one person do? I mean, let's cut him some slack as well. Yeah.
Personality as well. Who knows? Yeah.
But I'm lacking the general overview. But I would assume that he has played quite a role in just what we said, like gathering examples and gathering concepts and ideas. Not just for Dataviz in the more narrow sense, but also for the larger culture of this whole idea of visual thinking. Mm-hmm. And again, I was in the last book, I was missing references to researchers who have, you know, contributed to that line of thought. Mm-hmm. But I would just assume that he has contributed to this whole idea. I mean, now it's everywhere. Like everybody's sketch notes and like visual thinking is sort of like a practical thing that's pervasive. Maybe he has contributed with his collections as well.
Yeah. Mm. Maybe we all wouldn't have a job if he hadn't written the visual display of quantitative information in 1982. I think it's totally possible. But I'm not joking. So
I
am grateful for that. Yeah.
I have to say, Moritz, that going back to the idea of empirical evidence, in fact, there is a lot of additional empirical evidence that could be gathered by just sifting through his books and trying to figure out what holds and what doesn't, right?
Oh, yeah.
Effectively, the same is true for many other. Yeah, right? Think about, I'm now thinking about the work of Jacques Bertin. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, right? Yeah. Even Bertin has been producing a whole theory in a way much more structured than Tufte's.
Yeah. I was just going to say it's much more detailed and structured and layout.
I think it's also important that we move on from this perspective of, okay, there's this father figure that comes up with like strong convictions about what is good. And everybody keeps nodding and saying, yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
And the other things are bad, you know? And I think it's important that we also move on and see everybody's perspective on Dataviz as one perspective, not the perspective. And I think the field is there.
I agree.
But for
I
a
agree.
Few years, I was a bit worried that everybody would adopt the same dogma type views, you know, and sort of all the interesting stuff would be shut down by these. Mm-hmm. But person X said this and that, and that's why it's dogma and we can't do anything else.
Well, it's a bit of a pity that, I mean, what is great for Edward Tufte is that he was hugely successful and influential.
Oh, yeah.
And I admire that, like, as an author, like, wow. Mm. but on the other hand, this may also have, how do you say that, distorted the research field, in the sense that through all the attention put on his books, other voices may have been... Mm. May have not gotten the attention that they were,
sure.
that they deserved.
Yeah.
Because for like 20 years, I felt there was a sense that these were the books of Daedalus and like nobody else was writing about it. And that was not the case.
Yeah.
So he sort of took a bit of light away from other authors and researchers who were not so popular and whose books may not have been so beautiful. So maybe it's just our task for the future to sort of rediscover that line of research as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe true thought leadership is not like dominating a space and leaving no room for anybody else, but sort of also elevating others' voices or even dissenting voices the same way, right?
Referencing voices
referencing
in your books.
People.
Because that also makes a community.
Totally agree.
Yeah, I think, again, I never met him and never had any interaction with him, so I really don't know the man, right? In a way, it seems to be a missed opportunity that doesn't seem to engage with the larger community, right? I mean, by now, Daedalus is super popular. There are amazing designers out there.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he not engaging with their work or these people? I don't know. I mean, it seems to me mostly a missed opportunity. It would be really interesting to have a better sense of, I mean, right? A figure like that could actually play a much bigger role in the end, and maybe a positive one. I don't know. It seems to be a missed opportunity. But again, who knows? I never interacted with him, so can't say.
Yeah, and it's totally true. But on the other hand, the man has written 5 amazing books. So let's
exactly.
first do that ourselves, and then we talk again.
Exactly.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Cool. I think that pretty much concludes it, except you have a burning thoughts or theories.
I think we didn't mention.
Right?
We didn't mention his workshops. I don't know if anyone is. Have you ever been in one of his workshops or?
No, but there's a really fun review by Robert Kozara from 2012. He was part of one of the workshops. He didn't really enjoy it. So if you're looking for a good rant, that's a really nice one. We can link that one.
Yeah.
And I think it's mixed things. So some people say it's amazing, has like opened their eyes in like new ways. They're now enlightened. And others say, well, I read the books. It was nothing like, you know, sensational new, but it was good to hear it again. So I think that's mixed. But I haven't taken part in one too. I would be curious though. There's an online version now.
They,
you can take the online version.
I was just going to say they're online now. I mean, they have been since Corona times, I think. And I had the sense that they're generally good for like opening up the field to somebody who's not so much into it. Like Robert Kozara, at the time he wrote the review, was like and had been an esteemed researcher at one of the big software companies in the field. So he was as much as an insider as you could get.
Right.
So for him, this may have not been the right course. But I think it's more targeted to people who are more set, let's say, on the outskirts, trying to get more of an inside, like a general insight.
Maybe that's something for our listeners. If you have taken part in a Tufte course, let us know if you liked it or not, right?
Exactly. Good.
Yeah. Cool. I think we should wrap it up. We're over an hour, or maybe if we manage to edit it down, we're not, but at least we've been recording for a while. thanks so much for joining us.
Fun.
Yeah, that was a great
discussion.
That
was a lot of fun.
and get the books. I mean, it's everybody in Dataverse should have a couple of them at least. And
exactly.
And
the first one really, as we've said like many times, the first one is a classic. That's a must have basically.
Pour a glass of wine and go on the ride that is visual display of quantitative information. It's totally recommended. Yeah. Cool. And we will hope we will record soon again, not just in half a year or something. So we try to keep the rhythm now going, hopefully again a bit more.
Yes.
Fingers crossed. It will work out.
And thanks so much for having me. Wonderful to have really you on. Fun to get Lovely. Back together.
Yeah.
It's great to have you on.
Hopefully we can repeat that by times.
Mm-hmm.
That would be nice. Wonderful.
Okay.
Thanks so much and talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening to Data Stories again. Before you leave, a few last notes. This show is crowdfunded, and you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/datastories, where we publish monthly previews of upcoming episodes for our supporters. Or you can also send us a one-time donation via PayPal at paypal.me/datastories.
Or as a free way to support the show, if you can spend a couple of minutes rating us on iTunes, that would be very helpful as well. And here's some information on the many ways you can get news directly from us. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, so follow us there for the latest updates. We have also a Slack channel where you can chat with us directly. And to sign up, go to our homepage at datastory.es, and there you'll find a button at the bottom of the page.
And there you can also subscribe to our email newsletter if you want to get news directly into your inbox and be notified whenever we publish a new episode.
That's right. And we love to get in touch with our listeners. So let us know if you want to suggest a way to improve the show or know any amazing people you want us to invite or even have any project you want us to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't hesitate to get in touch. Just send us an email at mail@datastory.es.
That's all for now. Hear you next time, and thanks for listening to Data Stories.